Back in July, with the Republican and Democratic national conventions, TV ratings soared. These events were politics, to be sure, but they were also entertainment. Just ask Stephen Colbert.
These conventions can be fun to watch, but for the people involved, it is a blood sport that we just watch. It is bare-knuckle brawling. It's like the Hunger Games. No, it's worse than that. It's the Hungry for Power Games!
Colbert appears on screen dressed like a character from the Hunger Games, with tall blue hair and painted blue eyebrows above his own. He's an outsized version of himself, darting around the convention centers in Philadelphia and Cleveland before most of the cameras and lights are on. No detail, even the carpet color, is too insignificant for mockery. And some crassness, whether it's the Democrats.
Here at the Democratic National Convention, the rugs are all blue, so you'll notice that the carpet does match the drapes.
Or the Republicans.
The red carpet, of course, is here to hide the rivers of blood that will eventually pour down from the cornucopia when Donald Trump, flanked by his two eunuchs, takes the stage. By eunuchs, of course, I mean Paul Ryan and Rince Priebus, who clearly check their balls at the door this election. Naughty.
Colbert pulls back the curtain on the test runs of the teleprompters, from which the presidential nominees will later deliver their momentous addresses.
Oh, let's get a preview of Hillary's speech. This is a sample of the font size and text. This is a sample of the font size and text. And they say she's robotic. I don't understand.
And on Trump's screen?
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent. Oh, that's good. Who wrote that? That's fresh.
And before any of that starts to seem too informative or enlightening, Colbert makes sure there's still room for some blood sport in these Hungry for Power games, holding his phone screen up to the stuffed weasel he's carrying.
All right, Caligula, get the scent. Get the scent. And go find the emails.
The comedy, the tragedy, the lights, the cameras, the wardrobe, the scripts, it all confirms what we've already come to know. The election campaign in full swing is more than the greatest exercise of democracy and communal discernment. It's also great theater. I'm Brian Ellison. Every morning we bring you, every month we bring you a screen time show here on KCUR Central Standard. And this time it's not a movie or TV program we're focusing on, it's political theater. We're exploring how statesmen and stateswomen convert themselves every few years into reality TV stars. And reality TV stars, well, you know. Joining us in the critic's chair this time is David Martin. He's a staff writer for The Pitch. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Good to see you. If you had to assign a theatrical genre to this year's campaign, what would it be for you?
I'm not sure reality television is a theatrical genre, but that one's pretty close.
Why do you choose that one?
We've got a reality television star, of course, who won the nomination from one of the major parties, which is quite shocking, if you think about it. But you know, there's some elements of pro wrestling in here too. Donald Trump has actually appeared at WWE events in the past, and in some ways, I think his campaign is a little bit of a continuation of what we saw in the late 90s when Jesse Ventura became the governor of Minnesota. I think we maybe didn't recognize that as a portend to our current times.
You've got Hillary Clinton's campaign in there as well. Does it have those same reality TV elements, or would you choose a different genre for how she is presented to the public?
Her story almost seems like kind of a quest. Seems like she's been building towards something like this her entire life. You know, she's really has devoted her life to politics, as long as her husband has. And to me, it's kind of a quest story.
So you're a reporter here in Kansas City. You cover politics, although much of what you see, of course, like most of us, is not out on the trail. It's on TV. How does that affect our understanding of these issues and these candidates to be taking it all in through the screen?
You know, I think that's been one of the stories of the campaign is how much, particularly with Trump, that he's been able to have the success that he's had, relying almost exclusively on free earned media, as they call it. You know, he's not during the primary and during the general election, he's not flooded the airways with these really fancy commercials. It's just mostly been these events, the town hall type events that he has, and rallies and interviews, and it's so much of it has just been that kind of prime time. presentation of his ideas. And I think it's if I were a political consultant, I'd be a little bit worried about it, because I think he's kind of pointed out that what they do is maybe not all that valuable.
Uh-huh. How long have you been following politics?
I've been a reporter since about the early to mid-90s.
Does your interest in politics go back even before you were a reporter?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I grew up on my dad worked for a union, so, you know, probably a little bit more politics in our house than some others.
Yeah.
I think we may have interrupted a family trip to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, so he could go back and watch the Watergate hearings.
No kidding.
Yeah.
What's the first campaign that you actually remember watching?
I don't really remember the 1976 campaign, mm-hmm. But probably 1980 would be the first one that I really that I really remember.
You know, I think my first political campaign watching memory is also from the 1980 campaign. I remember election night. I remember the big map and watching the. I remember it as blue, even though today it would be red. But I remember the blue sweeping across the country and Ronald Reagan being elected. And I, for some reason, that image has stuck in my head from when I was, you know, 7 years old. So what are the images, the scenes that you find most compelling this year out of the campaign? What's the image that you think 20, 30 years from now someone else will say, that's what I remember?
One I can't shake is actually from Trump's announcement. I thought that was a pretty memorable event, because you had the escalator ride, which I thought was somewhat strange. And then I just loved the moment when
his initial announcement at Trump Tower, when he said he was running, he comes down the golden escalator to the podium.
Yes. And then he made some remarks, announced that he was a candidate. And then at one point, some technical person queued up some music. It was Neil Young's Rocking in the Free World, which I've always interpreted as a song as a rebuke against Reaganism. So that was kind of ironic. But he came in a little early, and Trump started making this violent cut sign to tell him to knock it off. And I just thought that was kind of a delightful, unscripted moment. And I think I think maybe one reason that sticks with me is we've seen it throughout the campaign, and it's really been so extemporaneous and slipshod in some cases. Even the Republican National Convention, I think, was kind of a slipshod affair. And so to me, that's one of the most memorable images.
Well, it's hard to get all the details right. And we're going to add to the conversation someone who's been on the other side of this, creating those scenes and setting up those shots. Stephen Jakes, welcome to you.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be here.
Glad you're here. You have been involved in politics now for a while. When did you first get involved?
My first staff position in a federal campaign was 1974 in Southwest Missouri. Springfield, Joplin area for a congressional candidate down there, Judge Richard Franks, and I drove a big old 23-foot motorhome that was done up with the Judge Richard L. Franks for Congress colors. It was a Dodge Mallard. We called it the Duck, and I was the Duck driver.
You were the Duck driver.
And then 76 was my first presidential. I worked for a guy by the name of Jerry Litton, congressman, was running for the Senate here in Missouri, a lot of people remember. Mm. And then after he died, I worked for Jimmy Carter, was my first presidential.
And you've worked mostly as an advance man. What does that mean?
Well, during presidential campaigns and during the White House, advance people are responsible. They send an advance team out during the campaign. You're lucky if you have 4 days. You're very unlucky if you have 24 hours to set up everything. And the goal is to control the press. And so what you see on television is what we create. And we try to choreograph all of it so the press get exactly what the pieces that we want them to get. And, you know, they know we're trying to, for lack of a better term, manipulate them. And we know they know, and they know we know they know. And so it's kind of a game that you play, but then, you know, you have them kind of captive, and you present the visuals that go with the message that the candidate or the president is giving.
And so you worked for Barack Obama in 2008. You were the lead advance for him, right?
I was a senior national lead advance throughout the campaign, 2007, 2008.
And so what were the messages or the images that you were trying to implant in those appearances?
Well, it depended on, you know, during the primaries, during the general, it depended on where you were. There was very much during the primaries, I was very concerned about a sense of place so that the people who were watching on local television knew we were in their state, very critical in that sense. When you're doing message situations, I had him here in Kansas City. I was lucky enough they were good enough to send me back every time he came to Kansas City. And then during his presidency in the first couple of years as well. And we did a message event at the refit center out at the airport. So there was, you know, we did it in the middle of a couple of big engines that were looking right into the press. And something dramatic that will sear the image of the message in people's minds graphically.
So one of the things that really defines the televised image of a campaign is the political conventions. And we heard sort of Stephen Colbert's mocking take on those. But what's it like to be behind the scenes at those things?
Oh, they're for the staff people, it's a lot of hard work. For the people that show up, you know, it's a good party. But for the staff people, it's a lot of hard work. Behind the scenes, first of all, the entire physical set has been created, designed, and created for months. So it's, you know, the best minds working for months to actually build something, whereas advanced people who are on the road sometimes have, you know, like a day or 2 days, as I said, to produce the visuals, to produce the entire event. Mm-hmm. At the conventions, what I've done at conventions is speaker tracking. So we're controlling the podium and all the speakers and making sure their speeches are edited correctly and done correctly, that they have – that all the speakers have practice at little podiums that we set up in the basement of these arenas to make sure that it looks exactly like it will from the stage when they get up there. So there's a lot of prep that goes into this that people never see, just even with the speakers that go out there. And each person as a speaker tracker, I'd have four or five speakers a night that I'd make sure that they got through there for 2 or 3 days, all the little prep that they had to do. So it's a lot of fun work when you're doing those. The real challenge is doing the real advance when you're sitting in a stadium and you know that in 2 days, you know, what there's going to be 35,000 people sitting there and the candidate's going to be in a certain place and the press is going to be in a certain place and this is how you're going to bring them in and you're the only one in the entire world who knows.
So one of the things that happens at these conventions is that the candidates get presented in a certain way and a lot of folks seem to think that that's the moment where America starts to really make up their mind about what the story of that candidate is. I want to ask the two of you to evaluate a couple of big moments from this year's conventions when the candidates were being introduced. And so first, from the Republican convention in Cleveland, the moment when Donald Trump arrived on stage to accept the nomination. And maybe you remember there was a fog machine and the lights went down. And then from out of the fog, a bright light. And let's listen to Judy Woodruff and Gwen Ifill describe it on the PBS NPR coverage.
Going to do what many nominees have not done, and that is show up at the convention on Monday night and speak. And it's going to be to introduce his wife, Melania.
Here he is. We're seeing Donald Trump kind of in profile, shadow, coming out with the light draining from his feet.
We are the champions.
The teleprompter the rises music. On both sides of him. We know he was never crazy about teleprompters, but he's there tonight, and the crowd is going wild. This is the guy they came to see. Donald J. Trump.
Well, there he is, she said. What did you think of that moment? What is that moment supposed to accomplish, David?
I think it's supposed to make him look powerful. An obvious comparison to make is the entrance that pro wrestlers make.
Well, you mentioned that he has appeared on WWE before. So.
Yeah, I think he remembered a few things from that appearance, you know, because that's a big part of the pro wrestling events is when the wrestlers make their way to the ring and there's a lot of smoke and fire and music and, you know, you're really building to the moment. I think there was some of that.
And I think I said in introducing that was when he was accepting the nomination. That's not correct. It was when he was actually there to introduce his wife when she was speaking earlier in the convention. Stephen, do you think it worked for what they were trying to do with it?
I'm biased, obviously, because I'm a Democrat, and I thought it was too cute by half. He's trying to create – as a guy who creates images and believes that images – create emotion, and that really is what moves people. I thought it was over the top, and people, I think the words in this campaign are really having a much greater effect than that kind of cheesy spectacle.
Well, another element of introducing these candidates and sort of rolling out their stories in many cases are these mini documentaries that sort of tell their life story. And at the Democratic convention in Philadelphia, we want to play a little bit of the Hillary Clinton movie. This is a bit of it, and it's just a bit of it as it was replayed later on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
Here is a woman. What does she dream of? When does she feel proud? How many times will she leave her mark? Many ways will she light up the world?
Wow, Morgan Freeman, perfect choice. Perfect choice. No, because who better to humanize Hillary Clinton than the man who made us fall in love with penguins, people?
All right. Well, Trevor Noah's comments aside, David Martin, what do you think of these mini documentaries?
I think people tend to enjoy them. I mean, particularly if it's the candidate that you tend to support. And I think it's interesting now is I think we're seeing Senator Clinton kind of go back to that. You know, immediately after the convention, she was really trying to hit Trump really hard. And I think now we're seeing in the last week or so, she's kind of getting back to that. I want to tell you my story. This is, you know, these are all the fights that I've fought, getting to know the person.
Yeah. Who makes those documentaries anyway, Stephen?
Private production companies that are hired by the campaigns. Usually they're people who, you know, they've worked with for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's effective. I think her story is probably something she needs to get back to all the years of doing all the good work and a very service-oriented kind of life, that she needs to tell her story and create a positive about herself to a greater degree now, and kind of let Donald create the negative for himself.
All right. Well, let's take a little break. If you two can stick around for a little bit, when KCUR Central Standard comes back, we're going to talk with two local theater directors. How would they assess what they're seeing on the season's campaign stage? And when the theater tries to take on politics, is fiction any stranger than truth? I'm Brian Ellison. Don't go away.
You know what the big difference is between Sanders and Hillary Clinton? I mean, aside from the fact that she has her own internet server in her house, whereas he isn't really sure he's online unless he hears this.
Welcome.
There you go. No, the real difference is that Hillary Clinton has professional image handlers telling her, hey, Hillary, you might want to comb your hair today and tomorrow and make it a regular thing. And hey, Hillary, instead of using your actual voice, maybe try to sound more like you're always from whatever region it is you're talking to. In fact, here's the Illinois-born, New England-educated New York senator speaking in South Carolina.
I'm aware I may not be the youngest candidate in this race, but I have one big advantage. I've been coloring my hair for years.
That, of course, was Senator Hillary Clinton and at the time, and, of course, Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Maybe there was a time when hair and clothing and how one used one's voice wasn't such a big deal on the campaign trail. Maybe. But as we're discussing today on KCUR's Central Standard, elections and politics are made-for-TV dramas these days. That's why they're the subject of our Screen Time edition today. I'm Brian Ellison, and joining us now are two folks who know a little something about hair and makeup and choreography and scripting. They worry about those things all the time on their own stages. Eric Rosen is Artistic Director of the Kansas City Repertory Theater. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
And also Heidi Van. She runs the Fish Tank Theater. That's a storefront alternative theater in the Crossroads. Heidi, good to see you.
Good morning. Thank you.
So let's start with this. If Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were the lead actors in an upcoming play that you were directing, each of them cast as the presidential nominees of their party who, you know, actually want to win, and you were watching these last few months of rehearsals, what changes would you be wanting made in the script at this point and in their performance? You hold the rehearsal, you look at Donald Trump, let's start with him, and you say, what? Eric?
Well, in the theater, we're very dramatic during rehearsals, and when actors aren't behaving the way we want them to, we'll say things like, if that actor does that one more time, I'm going to kill myself. And if I hear Donald Trump one more time say, believe me, I'm going to kill myself.
Okay.
Because it is literally the worst performance choice that one can make to remind the audience through your script constantly not to do the thing that you're asking the audience to do, right? So it's an actor basically saying, don't believe me, disregard me, don't take me seriously, which if you're in the theater and your lead actor is constantly in body language and voice going off script, the audience is going to be gone by intermission. And I feel like someone has to step in and say, my friend, say the words on the teleprompter in the order in which they're written, and you'll probably be better off than this improvised style, which doesn't play beyond the direct rallies of his fiercest supporters.
Yeah, that question of when to follow the script has been a really central question of the Donald Trump campaign, and it's clear that he doesn't like doing it. When he does it, it seems effective in the minds of some, but perhaps his performance isn't as convincing. Heidi, what do you think?
Well, I think that Donald Trump's performance has possibly altered the way that Hillary Clinton initially perceived that she was going to attack her campaign. And so she's had to pivot and perhaps play a different role than she was used to. Play like that clip showed, I'm changing the way that I speak, whether it's in dialect or inflection or I'm hard, I'm soft. But also I think she's getting a little bit more criticism on her performance based on the fact that she's a woman. She's getting there's a something that she said yesterday, like, if I wave my hands, it's too much. If I smile, it's too much. If I'm too stern, it's too much. So they're both being judged on completely different levels and sets of rules.
And I recognize that part of what I'm asking you both to do now is judge them on these sort of superficial right. standards, both male and female candidates. But do you have advice for Hillary Clinton that you would give her if you were her director at this point?
I would say stick to your truth, like who you are and that story, like and the resume of service and like the ambition, the epic quest that you said. Maybe you said quest, but I'll put the word epic into it, that and kind of roll that into this historical moment.
It's, you think there is a compelling narrative, you're perhaps questioning whether it's being told.
Right, because her antagonist is throwing what Mark Cuban just called as headline porn, like that diverts these little like bombs that it's like, I have to go put out this fire and I can't stay on my quest.
What advice would you give Secretary Clinton, Eric?
I think that the theatrics of personal narrative are very compelling for her. And I think she does well when she stays on that message. I saw something on social media the other day, a story about her as a applicant to law school at Harvard being screamed at by the male test takers that she didn't have to do this, that if she got their place, they would go off to Vietnam and die, that she should leave, and that she described that's how she became more closed off, that she had to close her eyes and stare and stare inside. And I think that's an incredible story in which we understand something about her. She tells that is honest, profound, and real, and explains a theatrical style that I think is going to be I think we'll see her turn to it, because we don't in public, and I think this is kind of horrible, we don't want women to be loud. We don't want women to raise their voices. We don't want women to be soft. We don't want them to be easy. I'm directing this production of Evita right now and watching how that character of Eva Perón, who was an interesting precursor to Hillary Clinton, was endlessly criticized for every choice she makes. She was too glamorous, not glamorous enough, no sex appeal, a hooker. And women in public, their theatrical performances have to constantly pivot and change. And I think it is only when they return to the authentic, grounded self that they can actually move forward. And I think that's what we'll be seeing.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that as we're talking about sort of the theatrical presentation of this, because both of you have sort of encouraged both candidates, frankly, to get to matters of substance or of their true person, because you think that will play better. It's not just a superficial issue. The substantive is most effective out on the stage, is what you're saying.
Well, not to get too pointy-headed, but you know, for the ancient Greeks, the difference between rhetoric and poetics, between public speaking and theater, there wasn't one, right? So the actor in public followed the same rules, whether it was fiction, performing a tragedy, or making a speech to the Senate. And the same rules of ethos, of authenticity, of truth narrative, of the correct mise-en-scene or spectacle apply whether you're standing at a podium addressing 10,000 people or you're standing at the rep addressing a bunch of people who paid a lot of money to come see you pretend to be someone else.
So with those very insightful comments, let me turn the corner to those more superficial, when you're talking about politics, but very important in the theatrical world elements, things like clothing and makeup and the choices that certainly we know campaigns do agonize over and think a great deal about. To sort of put us in the mood, I want to play a moment from the Republican convention coverage again. This is the moment when Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's daughter, comes on stage to introduce her father. And Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff are describing that scene again for the NPR and PBS audiences. Let's take a listen.
And now we're about to see Ivanka Trump. The audience is rising to its feet.
The sign behind the stage says, Make America Great Again. And here comes Ivanka Trump in a white dress walking right up to the podium.
That was my favorite moment when Melania Trump came out the other night and Judy said she's in a white dress. We're not, we kind of know fashion.
We're big on white.
Ivanka Trump is getting a warm reaction.
All right. So what do you think of this commentary from the two top journalists at PBS on the clothing of the speakers? What do you make of that, Heidi?
Well, I wondered if they commented on the color of Chelsea Clinton's dress when she came out to speak for her mother, or is it because this character, who is gilded in money and glamour and has these paper doll children and wife and family set up in front, that if that's why that was noted. I mean, they're presented very high class.
The physical appearance is part of the story. It's not an incidental detail.
It's who they are.
Yeah.
Not just the appearance, you're saying, but actually the style, the Dior, the rings, the hair, the wealth
glamour
displayed.
Well, but these aren't incidental decisions. Well, you mentioned Eva Perón. I mean, these aren't incidental decisions on the stage. Mm-hmm. You probably go through dozens of choices before deciding which dress will appear in a certain scene, right?
You have no idea. There are 17 dresses in Evita, of which we designed probably 400 based on historical research. And so I got to know everything about what she wore through her lifetime and how her sartorial changes matched her aspirations. So she did wear an entirely white ensemble as she got on the plane to go to Europe when she was trying to present herself as a girl who was barely literate at 15 and had kind of slept her way up, was now the glamorous first lady in a Dior suit heading off to Europe. Those choices matter, and they've always mattered, probably more for women than for men.
Right, because, Donald Trump is wearing a suit and most of his ties are red,
and that's a short commentary.
A navy blue,
there's not
a dark
much else to
suit.
Say.
Not to be too catty, there are some choices that the Trump people could work on. My friend David Crummer just posted on Facebook a close-up of Donald's hair, in which one can see the toupee line very clearly. And I would say, if you're going to work that hard to pretend that you don't have a toupee, there are ways to make it look good.
I mean, they could talk to someone in theater.
It's not that hard.
Right.
It's pretty shocking.
And he doesn't have a lot of makeup on.
Yeah.
Or any.
I think he's getting kind of lazy with the whole hair thing. The wig people he needs to work on better wig people.
Well, I'm delighted that we here at Central Standard have provided an opportunity to be catty about a male candidate for this. So that's excellent.
He put it out there for us.
I'm only asking you to speak your truth. You both have staged actual political theater. You're really doing it right now with Evita, Eric. What makes Evita work would you call it a political drama, by the way?
Absolutely. And it's no accident that we're doing it right now during this political cycle.
It makes sense.
I love politics and theater, not when I wouldn't right now do a play about the Clintons, or I wouldn't do a play about Trump. I would do what Brecht says, which is to always, the great German dramatist Bertolt Brecht said, if you want to talk about now, talk about then. You must always historicize. So looking at a story that's now from the 1940s to illuminate our now makes the theater feel kind of alive. And when you're looking at something from 1951 and thinking, my God, that could have been on the cover of the magazine today, then your theater is really alive, and politics of now and the politics of then align and teach us something.
Heidi, I know you recently wrote and directed a show at the Fish Tank called Second Ladies.
I did.
What political story was that about?
So Second Ladies was inspired by the fact that there is a woman that is on track or has the opportunity to become the first female president. So it made me think about, there will be a male first lady, and what has the role of the first lady been historically, and will that change when a man takes that office? But also the influence of the feminine on politics and power, not just by wives, but by mistresses and other women that roamed around the White House and the Oval Office. So it was called Second Ladies. It was the interesting thing about producing political theater during a hot political climate. We were right after the Republican convention, and so it was percolating. It was hot. But then when it when the politics just started to weigh us all down, it's like no more political theater, because especially like contemporary pop political theater because it's all on our phone. Like, we can experience that political theater whenever we want to by looking at our devices.
Is there something that makes for good political theater as opposed to very unsatisfying political theater? What are the key elements, and are those the same things that you find in a campaign that you find compelling?
Well, first of all, I think all theater is political in the sense that we come together in public to hear ideas, and that's the nature of politics. The best theater of political nature to me doesn't give us answers, doesn't tell us how to vote, doesn't tell us what to think, but it invites us to have conversation either between ourselves and the play or between ourselves and other audience members afterwards. It opens up questions and makes us realize the risks and rewards of the challenge of public life.
Heidi?
Yeah, also like what Eric was saying about looking to the past and fusing it in the future, and like with this perfect moment of where we are, that those things meld and we see where we've come, and that perhaps we were closer before, and what is different, what, you know, is it better, is it worse, like what made this opportunity now, what made this opportunity then, and a heightened awareness. That's what I like.
Well, let's dig even deeper into the political theater that is this year's campaign season. After a break, we'll come back and continue that conversation. We also want to invite our listeners to it. How would you assess the theatrical, the artistic, the entertainment quality of this campaign? Give us a call at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. I'm Brian Ellison, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Brian Ellison. It's a Screen Time edition of KCUR's Central Standard, and this time the program in question is the 2016 election campaign in all its televised, scripted, choreographed glory. We've got a big roundtable here to talk about it. Stephen Jakes is author of the novel Advance Man. It's fictional, or is it? Eric Rosen is artistic director of The Rep, with Evita opening previews tonight. Heidi Vann runs the Fish Tank Theater. She's also an actress, by the way, in Hand to God, which is running right now at the Unicorn. And David Martin, you can check out his riveting coverage of the Intercontinental Hotel and city taxing issues right now in The Pitch. Sorry, David. It's dramatic enough.
Thanks for the plug.
There you go. We're talking about how the campaign is theater and how theater is political. Another area of unquestionable theater in a campaign is political ads. And, of course, we could spend many shows on that topic alone. I do want to get the table's reaction, though, to a couple of ads in particular that have gotten a lot of play in Missouri recently. This one especially before the primary election for the now Republican nominee for governor, Eric Greitens. Just to set the scene, he's standing on a country road with an AR-15 rifle slung over his shoulder, and, well, here's what happens.
I'm Eric Greitens. For too long, Missouri's been run by career politicians, owned by corrupt consultants, high-paid lobbyists, and special interests. While they get rich, Missourians are hurting. Well, I'm no career politician. I'm a Navy SEAL, and I'll take dead aim at politics as usual. I'm Eric Greitens. If you're ready for a conservative outsider, I'm ready to fire away.
That is Republican gubernatorial nominee in Missouri, Eric Greitens, in one of his campaign ads back in the primary. There's actually another one where he's firing an even larger gun into a pond for about 20 seconds of the commercial. And at the end, he sort of turns to the side and smiles and nods, sort of like he's saying, yeah. Let me turn to our political operative, Stephen Jakes. What in the world?
Well, it's obvious pandering. And I mean, again,
pandering to whom?
Well, it's pandering to his conservative base, who, you know, that for whom the simplicity of that issue is compelling, and the issue, you know, the Second Amendment issue, supposedly.
But I have to say, I mean, we had on Tuesday here on this very program, we had folks who all have guns and support gun rights, who for whom I don't think they would regard that as a simplistic issue. I can't speak for them, but who is this really working for?
Those were primary ads.
Yeah.
So they're working for his primary, his audience, and obviously it worked. He won the primary, didn't he?
He indeed did over three other pretty
strong
candidates.
Well, you notice his general election ads have softened up. He's talking about a nonprofit now,
right? The nonprofit he runs for veterans. David Martin, is there any way for an ad to actually be substantive, or is this pretty much what one should expect these days?
In retrospect, we made fun of those ads when they came out because they're so bonkers, but they. they worked. It was a crowded, you know, there were three other candidates in the Republican primary. And it really, I mean, if you look back on it, it looks like it was a really successful way for him to differentiate himself from the other candidates. You know, I'm not some person who's going to drone at you in a suit. I'm a man of action. And, you know, he softened them a little bit, but they still kind of are in that action hero vein. You know, now instead of firing a gun, it's more I'm, you know, doing good. But they really still are kind of, they're in some ways, they're still pretty consistent with that message of I've got big biceps and I'm going to fix things and take care of you.
Which he's wearing a pretty tight-fitting T-shirt yes. in those ads as well. Heidi, your reaction?
Don't you think that the spectacle and buffoonery of the Trump campaign opened the door for this sort of commercial? I mean, wouldn't this be outrageous if we didn't have this other, like the fog and the we are the champions, all of that playing? Like, they're copying what's working on a larger level, on a state level.
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, to the point, I mean, Stephen, you've worked in campaigns for 30, 40 years here. Is this unusual? Is this a new level, or is this just how it works?
No, Heidi's correct. This is a continuing coarsening of our public discourse. And certainly Trump has created that to a much larger extent, trying to be kind. You're absolutely right. This is lowest common denominator stuff has become even lower.
Well, so let's, for comparison, let's take a look at one of Chris Koster's. I think this is fair to say this is a typical ad. It's actually a 60-second ad. We may not hear all of it. It starts with these shots from a helicopter of the Cass County Courthouse. There's still shots of children and mothers. There's a lot of camera angles of Chris Koster just speaking directly to the camera, looking very serious. Here's how this starts.
There were no lobbyists or fancy offices in Harrisonville. As county prosecutor, my job was simple. Put away the bad guys. Take care of the people they hurt. I didn't fight against domestic violence by making speeches. I put the abuser behind bars and made sure the woman with the black eye and her kids had a place to sleep. For those 10 years, my job was helping people in the small towns of rural Missouri, person by person. I'm Chris Koster, and as Attorney General, that job's never changed. Protecting victims of violence and corruption, putting crooked corporate big shots in prison, even suing Barack Obama's EPA to keep federal regulators off our land.
All right, so that's Attorney General Chris Koster, the Democratic nominee for governor in Missouri. A different kind of tone in that ad, to be sure. Is it visually, audibly as effective, Eric Rosen?
Well, I work in musical theater quite a lot, and we do a lot with music, and that ad is as much about the underscoring as it is about the content, that guy manages to jump from domestic violence issues to Obama's EPA policies is made possible only because the music accelerates, it changes keys, it goes up, it moves us, mm-hmm. right? And that rather than the bombastic ad of the previous ad, this is saying, I'm one of you, I'm like you, I'm with you, I'm advancing the cause, the river is moving, and feels both progressive and folksy, right? So he's making a great country western musical out of his ad.
Which is theater, pure and simple, right?
Yep.
That's how you're supposed to do it.
That's how I make my living.
David?
I can't get over how much he sounds like Robert Redford.
He had a great voice.
It's uncanny. Yeah. I mean, he looks like him too, but I think the voice even more so.
I have to say, he doesn't smile in these ads, and I recognize that it's not a happy, fun topic he's talking about, but there's a cold, steely seriousness.
And actually, he's done that. I've noticed this throughout his career, particularly when he was a little bit younger. It was a trick that John Edwards had used. That a lot of times in his photographs, it would be black and white. And the point of that would be, you know, he's a young, handsome man. And I think it was the point of that would be, I think I'd read this about John Edwards, that he did that to lend gravitas, to say, oh, I'm just not teeth and hair. I'm really a man of substance.
Want to invite any listeners to join us at 816-235-2880.
888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCURCST. We got a tweet from Brian who says, your guests portray Hillary as a heroine on a noble quest. He says, she's more like an agent from The Matrix. She seems impervious to everything. So you can choose your own literary character that you'd like to compare the lead characters in this story to, but Brian's going to go with The Matrix instead of a noble quest.
Well, I think the quest narratives that I would place the Clinton campaign in is also Shakespeare, right? So Shakespeare heroes are often villainous, are often do complicated and challenging, make complicated, challenging lifelike choices. So rather, there are ways to think of the theatrical narrative of the Clinton campaign in as epic without that saying that it's necessarily heroic.
Yeah, and go ahead, Heidi. I'm sorry.
Well, I love thinking about this because they're both epic. And they're both quests, and the hero will be decided on election day. And then we will either see where their fatal flaw was, where their Achilles heel is, like all of these ways that we analyze and structure a piece of theater. Like those pieces are yet to be laid out, and we get to watch them either come to the top of the mountain and put the flag in and have the fog machine come back up, or that, you know, stoic in the podium, thank you for your support. We had a good run. But we can't project what this script is possibly going to be because new things keep coming at us every day. That's like, it's exciting for us to watch, but I think it will be super epic how they go down, like just spinning with smoke and flames.
You know,
at least I hope.
Well, I think that is always the great drama of election night, right? That you even after you know the results, you stay up late because you want to
hear about it all over again.
You want to see the speeches. Eric mentioned music as a key factor in that commercial by Chris Koster, but music is actually a big deal at live events. It's a big deal at the conventions, as we heard earlier. I don't know. We even have had some controversies over recorded songs that are used, and then the artists behind those songs complain that they don't really support that candidate, and they don't want to see their music used in support of him or her. Stephen, how does that work? How do you get music involved in the campaign?
Well, what's interesting is through the years, as things have become more prescribed and by headquarters and more cookie cutter in terms of the visuals and in terms of the events that you put on. They then started sending out the music that was proscribed that you had to use. There was a CD that would go out that the site people would use for music before the rally or after the rally or before a town hall meeting.
To ensure that you didn't use something that would get you in trouble.
Right, and it had been looked at again by people who thought, okay, this is going to set the right mood or whatever. And then in certain places, just for the fun of it, especially if it's rallies, I'd throw in my own. You know, I'd ask permission first. But, you know, if you're in Texas, you know, he's not from Texas, but Texas wants you anyway by Lyle Lovett.
Oh.
I used that, I think, for that was an Obama event.
Mm.
And they said that was fine to go ahead and use it. So, you know, you're trying to set a tone because you want the TV cameras to see people who are energized and up. And so music plays a role even in the live events.
Yeah.
Even just the difference between the Republican convention having like canned music, it did have an air of pageantry, just like a Trump pageant. But the live band with the Democratic convention was more of kind of personable, like the late night shows that we watch, and they're just kind of accentuating or enhancing what's going on.
Although there was a live band at least some nights of the Republican convention too, right? I remember being struck. I thought it was actually maybe a joke when the live band at the Republican convention was playing "You Can't Always Get What You Want." Am I making that up?
That is actually what played during the acceptance moment with the balloons and all that. Which, by the way, the stage management on the balloons was really bad because they were like 30 seconds late.
Right, at the Republican convention.
Yeah,
and then at the Democratic convention, I don't think I've ever seen.
By the way, you'd be impressed at how much staging goes into just the balloon drop.
Say more about that.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's just, you know, the amount of effort, the amount of time, the amount of practice. And, you know, I mean, just if you're 30 seconds late, you look like an idiot.
Right. That's a big deal.
So, there's experts. There are actual balloon drop experts.
A 30-second late in the radio would be a very big deal.
Someone got fired.
Well,
probably got promoted.
I think the Democratic convention had the largest and most I don't know, complicated balloon drop I've ever seen. There were small, medium, and large balloons. They seemed to be in different colors in different sections of the room. It was quite something.
I enjoyed some of the
comments on social media afterwards, and there were some people started creating some memes of Bill Clinton handling the balloons because he seemed to really enjoy that.
Yeah, because they were bigger than usual.
Like he'd never seen a balloon
before.
Yeah,
he was clutching them in his hands like it was like a watermelon at a state fair. He's like, wow, this is an awesome balloon show.
Which maybe is not the shot they were going for. But, you know, the other event that's left in this epic story of this presidential campaign are the debates, which, of course, are the other big made-for-TV event. I'm curious, Stephen, what does a campaign do to prepare for the messaging and the visuals of these debates? They can really turn the whole election.
They can, and a good candidate will go through weeks of prep. Just you know, you go back to college and you just make sure you know everything so you don't come up with an Aleppo moment like yesterday morning when Gary Johnson didn't know what Aleppo was. Those types of things. The entire setting is negotiated with the National Debate Commission and then with the individual venues. So that goes on for weeks in advance. Washington University in St. Louis has done it so many times, they've got it down pat. Those are the least controlled of the situations. Other than the prep, once the candidate gets out there, you know, he or she is on his or her own.
Yeah.
That's the least amount of control you have over a situation like that.
Right. There's almost no other moment like that in a campaign where it's just them on the stage and there's nothing you can do about it.
That's right. You've got your control is totally gone. When one of the, I think it was 2004, I was doing the one at Wash U, and the debate commission and the campaigns had negotiated there'd be no reaction shots from the cameras. Well, the cameras aren't controlled by the campaigns. The cameras are controlled by the networks. That was the silliest thing I'd ever heard. The reaction shots are totally at the discretion of the people who are running the cameras. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't have control over a situation like that, and you just got to hope that your candidate's going to be good.
I am struck by thinking about the primary campaign and the many, many debates, especially on the Republican side when there were 10 candidates on the stage at the same time, and how much the crowd was a part of those debates with their hooting and hollering or their booing or their cheering. The presidential debates in this stage of the campaign have generally been very sober affairs without any applause. In fact, the audience instructed not to applaud until the end of the debate. David, do you think that helps one candidate more than the other in this case?
It's hard to say just because I'm just having a hard time just even visualizing Senator Clinton and Donald Trump on the same stage. Because, you know, this whole time they've been in different universes. Mm-hmm. And to think that they're finally going to come together and start hashing out some of these issues, it's hard to even visualize that in my head than to even think about the kind of crowd shots or something like that. I mean, I could see a scenario where Donald Trump goes off script a little bit and starts getting booed. Something like that, I guess, could happen. But I think they'll probably try to manage that.
Yeah. Heidi and Eric, you're both playwrights as well as actors and directors. I'm going to put you on the spot. Sometimes there's one big line that makes the difference in the debate. So think of Lloyd Benson saying to Dan Quayle, "Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy," these other moments.
Where's the beef?
Right. Well, and some of the ways Jack Kennedy actually spoke to Richard Nixon in those debates. Can you think of a line or maybe a moment that you would want to make sure happened at a debate to help your either candidate? Putting you on the spot.
That's a really hard question.
That is really hard.
With only 30 seconds left in the show.
I think it's going to be really interesting when you see those two people in a room together in a live format. It's like our protagonists of this story have been marching towards the same place. And so the question of how they negotiate eye contact, how they relate to each other physically, do they touch each other, do they shake hands, do they not shake hands, those optics are going to be really important. And how Secretary Clinton manages to set a tone in whatever she says that contrasts whatever we low-grade pass Trump to go kind of crazy.
Do you have a line, Heidi?
I just think we have this alpha male and this alpha female going, and like what you're right, like who sets the tone? How will the field be laid? Like, it's too soon to tell. That's my line. Too soon to tell.
Too soon to tell, and that is the final word. Stay tuned to the 2016 campaign for the final chapter coming up in November. I want to thank all of our guests, David Martin of The Pitch, Stephen Jakes, author of Advance Man, Eric Rosen from The Rep, and Heidi Van from the Fish Tank Theater. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.
To hear this show again, you can go to kcur.org/Central Standard later this afternoon. You can also find all our past shows there. By the way, KCUR is providing lots of actual election coverage about issues and candidates and things like that. So visit our website for that, too. Twitter's a great way to keep in touch with the show. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at PTS Brian. On Monday, join us at 10 a.m. for Invisibilia, and then Central Standard returns on Tuesday with the story of the Exoduster movement, the migration of African Americans post-slavery from the rural South to places like Kansas and its impact on farming to this day. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, and Fridays by Jen Chen. Our team also includes Suzanne Hogan and Andrea Tudhope, with help from our intern, Zach Klammen. Linda Scher is our announcer, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Gina Kaufman's on leave. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great weekend, everyone.